Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Cliff Nesteroff is a well-respected comedy historian and writer who calls Hollywood, California, home. Originally from Slocan, British Columbia, Nesteroff has appeared on networks like CNN and Vice as an expert who can discuss comedy and show business. He was last on this show to discuss his probing 2017 television series Funny How, and also his remarkably comprehensive book The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy, which was published in 2015 and remains a towering achievement. In 2021, Simon & Schuster published another astonishing overview by Nesteroff. It's called We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans in Comedy. And Cliff returns to this show to discuss why he took this project on, his trepidation about being a white man writing a reflection on indigenous arts, and why it essentially became an oral history, the reception the book has received from indigenous comedians and audiences, Charlie Hill's life and comedy breakthrough as a Native American stand-up, racist stereotypes and very, very funny indigenous people, his next book, other future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like the New Pornographers, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 618th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Cliff Nesteroff with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Cliff. How's it going?
Good, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to talk to you again. It's been a long time. Congratulations on another wonderful book, if I might say.
Thank you.
It's beautiful. Now, we'll talk about it in a bit, but first of all, where in the world are you?
I am in Hollywood, California. Hollywood, USA.
Hollywood, USA. Are you in the same place, likely? I don't remember how long ago we talked. It's been a few years, but have you moved much since the last time we chatted? Do you know? Same apartment?
Different building, but I am same zip code, maybe just a few blocks east of where I was before, but still in historic Hollywood, USA, a beautiful national historic district, all 1920s architecture, all 1920s silent movie scandals living ghostly around me. And sunshine and orange groves, man.
Far cry from what life is like here in Edmonton, Alberta, I must say.
Oh my God, were you sent there? Voluntarily?
It was a conscription. My wife is from, her family's from here. And then we left Ontario in January of 2020 for work. We got better jobs and we thought, you know, it'd be closer to my wife Michelle's family, and then the pandemic happened.
Wait a second. You moved to Edmonton voluntarily in January?
Yeah, there's a little lilt in your tone that I don't like. I'm not happy about it, but yeah, we did do that. We did those things, and then within 2 weeks, to your point, it was like minus 40 degrees Celsius for like 2 weeks. Record-breaking cold.
Is it legal to move to Edmonton in January? Is the Health Canada doesn't step in and say this is a bad idea?
There were some people who questioned the decision. Yes, my mechanic who I had my 2005 Toyota Matrix shipped out here, and before, which was dumb because they have very, very prohibitive out of province inspections that occur. They told me when I got here with the car, the mechanic's like, dude, seriously, anything more than 2 years, you're failing. I'm like, what? Come on. I had this all safetied in Ontario. And the Ontario mechanic was, I said, do you get much of this? People, you know, going to Alberta from here and getting their car safetied? And he went, never that way. It's always the other way. People come here from Alberta. So that was a bad omen in a sense, too.
Now the verb safetied sounds like another Canadianism. What is here in California, you get your car smogged. That's a verb.
Smogged. Yeah. Like an emissions test kind of thing.
Yeah. So the verb is smogged. You're good to go if you've been smogged.
Right. Safety
sounds like the Canadian equivalent in some way.
Now, just hold on a second. For those who don't know, you're Canadian. Don't try to brush this off, your Canadianism. You've never heard of a car being safety? That's when. So basically, if you have a transaction and you sell your car to someone, ideally they would get it safetied first by a mechanic. A mechanic goes through the whole car and determines what is safe and what isn't. And if things are repairable for safety, you repair them before you sell it or give it to someone else. So that's what a safety is generally. So I wanted to make sure it was safetied because I knew there was an outer province inspection looming. So yeah, I had it safetied and they said, yeah, it needs a bit of work. And I got that work done. Then I put it on a truck. It cost me like $3,000 to do all that stuff. And then it got here and immediately, you know, I took it to get the outer province inspection. They're like, no way, not going to happen. I was like, really? So I got screwed by Alberta right away. That's all I'm saying.
Wow.
Then we got my family and I got a minivan, like a 2020 minivan, which I was excited about. And I drove it from the dealership to where we were staying at my in-laws' house, got a speeding ticket. Very first trip. And they have camera radar here. So I didn't know I got the speeding ticket until 3 weeks later. I'm like, this is the first trip. So I just, and then there was a pandemic. There is a pandemic. I mean, depending on when people listen to this, if it's 5 years from now, there was a pandemic, but there is a pandemic now. And so everything has gone to hell. Like we moved and the whole world ended basically. So this seems like a nice segue. How has your year and a bit of pandemic life been, Cliff? Has it been okay in Hollywood?
I mean, it's been okay for me. I don't watch or follow the news anymore. Once I got the bad news about the pandemic, and once I personally was safetied for, you know, any pandemic navigation, had a mask.
You went down to the mechanic and got safetied for the pandemic? Is that what happened?
Yeah, they said the mechanic told me, yeah, you got to wear a mask, you got to sanitize,
right?
You got to stay home as much as possible. And so I did that. But then if you go to like Bakersfield, they don't have the same safety restrictions. They got different. It's like Ontario and Alberta. You can not wear a mask and die and it's okay there. But my pandemic has been all right. You know, I work from home to begin with. I sit at home and I read and write no matter what. It has remained sunny in California. But during the pandemic's first summer, as you'll recall, there are wildfires up and down the West Coast.
Yeah.
And we had to like stay inside because you literally couldn't breathe the air. Like if you went outside and tried to inhale, it was like physically painful and you couldn't really do it. So the fact that there was a pandemic and wildfires that made you have to stay inside made it real bad, real bad.
Yeah.
But now that that is cleared up, living in a sunshiny climate with palm trees and all that really does make the pandemic much more manageable for me. I don't know how you would do it in Canada. So even though people think I'm crazy to live in America instead of Canada, when you take into account everything that's been going on, for my mental health, sunshine really does wonders. And so Hollywood remains the place for me. And universal vaccinations are occurring the week that we're recording this. Everybody in California now qualifies for a vaccination. So.
Oh, well, that's good for you. Do you have one scheduled for yourself or have you had one yet?
Scheduled it today.
Oh, good for you. That's great. Yeah, we're way behind here. I don't know that we'll have them before my family and I don't think, well, my wife and I should say, I don't think we'll have ours before July, maybe. That's what they told us. But then like former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, he tweets something like, I walked into the Shoppers Drug Mart and I got vaccinated. And I don't know if that's true. I don't generally think the things he said or says are true, but, if that's the truth, then maybe I will wander into a Shoppers Drug Mart and see about getting vaccinated.
Yeah. Why would he lie now that he is retired, though? Like his profession, his job was to be a liar for years. But now he's retired. So what benefit about lying about Shoppers Drug Mart would there be?
Well, I will argue that he was ushered into a forced retirement based on an election result. But politicians, as you know, they never really go away. They can come back too. You know, they have
he sort of did go away, or maybe it's because I live in California, I never hear about him. But I feel like Justin Trudeau so upstaged Stephen Harper that he's very seldom mentioned. Is he really still actively
you're on to something. He's generally been pretty quiet. He pops up every once in a while to criticize things, but generally pretty quiet. Yeah, that's fair. But he did pop up for this. And to be honest, In the grand scheme of things, given the way most, for some reason, conservative-leaning politicians and their followers tend to go, he made a point of saying he got vaccinated, you know, wasn't anti-masking, wasn't hoaxing. So that's good. That might be good.
I'm no fan of Stephen Harper. I'm no fan of Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
But the juxtaposition of the way a right-wing politician operates here and the way a right-wing politician operates there is drastically different.
Yes.
There's very few right-wing politicians here who would make a spectacle of getting free health care, socialized medicine, and a vaccination shot, and then tweet it to the world without some sort of coded racist message. it's a very, very different, very different world. I'm an optimist now. I'm a bright side looking guy. America is horrific and chaotic. I'm getting vaccinated before you are somehow, despite all of that. Stephen Harper is tweeting out a photo showing the virtues of socialized medicine, despite being a right-wing villain, you know.
Yeah.
So I try and not be too dogmatic and too hostile. I gotta acknowledge the differences between the countries when something's positive versus negative. But I do loathe everything that he said and did.
I actually wondered about this. It sounds like you're a little keeping Canada's political climate at a bit of an arm's distance now that you're ensconced in Hollywood. But you have family here in British Columbia still, I assume. Is that fair?
I have a mother and a brother.
Yeah.
And my father is not all there. He's in a home. He's still there.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But so those three.
Okay.
In Canada.
So where I was going with that, and I'm sorry to hear about your father, but
cut that part out. I didn't mean to bring it, make it a big downer here.
No. It's fine. I asked the question. My point is, I wondered if you are checking in with them, and as a result, are you hearing about how Canada is faring during this pandemic? Because, as you say, it is a little unusual. Who would have thought, a year ago, let's say, with the president that America had and the leadership that Canada had, that America would be, fast-tracking their citizens to vaccines, whereas Canada seems to be lagging behind. Have you heard this kind of commentary from your family or friends here in Canada at all?
I haven't heard it from family and friends. I see tangentially, complaints on Twitter and in the news and whatnot. But like I said, I've been trying not to pay attention to the news because I don't like the running tally, the way they treat the pandemic like it's a sporting event, like this is the score. Now, or like same thing when the elections are happening and they're showing the percentages like hour by hour, day by day, breakdown of demographics. I don't need that kind of number crunching. All I have to know is, what can I do? What can I not do? And that's it. And because it's been the same for so long, I've just sort of ignored it because mental health, the more you focus on the news, the worse it gets, the more paranoid you get, the more upset you get. And in the old days of just having a newspaper delivered to your front door, you would sit down, you would read the newspaper, there would be some terrible news in there, you get upset. And then you'd get rid of the newspaper. You didn't keep going back to the same newspaper and rereading the same headline over and over and over all day long and keep scrolling through the newspaper all day long until you went insane. But that's what people do with news on the internet and social media. You're just looking at the same notifications of how things are getting worse and worse and worse. And, oh, there's going to be a vaccine. Oh, but now there's a worse virus, and all these types of things. And it doesn't help you navigate or circumvent anything better. As long as you're an informed person, you can step away from the news and not be less informed. Actually, sometimes you're going to be more ill-informed or more insidiously affected. Your mental health will be arrears. You think you're informed, but really it's creating a mental health crisis. So I try and avoid it as much as possible, and good luck to everybody. We're going to get out of it soon, but I try not to obsess over it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I've been trying to get better at it. It's been a bit hard. I like to stay informed. But to your point, there is a fine line between being informed and driving yourself into anxiety and stress by being informed. So it's a.
I find that because I've, this might sound pompous, but because I've read and read a lot of history and educated myself as a historian, I can kind of like step outside of the present and sort of look at a bigger picture sort of angle and look at historic presidencies. And, you know, during the Trump era, I did that when fascism was percolating. To look at the history of fascism and acknowledge that as much suffering and destruction as fascism has imposed on different societies over the course of history, at the same time, fascism in every circumstance has also collapsed and imploded and ended, and something beneficial followed later. You know, there's always a reaction against fascism eventually. So I was just sort of looking at those types of things, seeing where and how the clouds part historically, and they always seem to eventually part, even if people suffer or die along the way, not to diminish that, but eventually humanity comes out of it. And maybe that sounds like a flaky perspective on it, but when you study history and you see that nothing lasts forever, when things are really bad, that can give you a little bit of hope.
Absolutely, yeah. And I feel like this could be, in a way, a segue into our discussion of your book. We had a little real estate problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans in Comedy. Maybe a clumsy segue, but I feel like it's sort of there. I think it sort of works.
I thought you were going to say maybe a clumsy subtitle. I thought that's what you were about to say.
I try not to insult my guests until at least half an hour has passed. No,
yeah.
No, not at all. I think it's a... So as I was saying, this is a really well-written book. I was marveling. I've been rereading it, actually, and I read it once, and I'm reading it again. And because some of the structural things that you got up to, I was just marveling at them. I was telling my wife, yeah, he does this amazing thing. Like, you're bouncing around history, and you're bouncing between sort of different, let's call them characters or figures in history. But Cliff does this remarkable thing where he kind of seamlessly connects them chapter by chapter. And it's anyway, I want to get into that stuff as well. But it's a really wonderful book. Very simply, Cliff, what inspired you to write this book in the first place? I'm curious.
Well, I was asked to write it by Simon & Schuster. I had gotten offers after writing my first book, The Comedians, which was a history of stand-up. I got a number of offers to write other books, but almost all of them, for some reason, were about modern contemporary comedy, and I am by trade a historian. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand why publishers didn't grasp that. They all wanted me to write about Netflix, podcasts, the modern comedy boom. At one point, I was asked to ghostwrite Dan Harmon's memoir.
Oh.
And I was like, why? Do you know who I am? Do you think I'm somebody else? Like, why would I?
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was turning all of those down. And then at one point, my agent was like, well, I got nothing else for you, because I had written a bunch of proposals, history things, and they didn't sell. And so my agent was like, there's a publisher and they will give you a book deal if you write a book about contemporary comedy. So for the book proposal, I wrote things into the proposal that would interest me. As opposed to bore me, and writing about podcasts or Netflix seemed boring.
Yeah,
but I included this one chapter in the proposal, would have just been a 10-page chapter, about the rise of indigenous comedians today. Because, you know, for generations, there's been very few First Nations comedians or Native American comedians of prominence. And now, because comedy is so popular the past few years with podcasts, Netflix, what have you, there have been at least 100 indigenous stand-up comedians, improvisers, sketch performers to emerge just in the last 5 to 10 years. So I thought that was interesting, and I was just going to talk about that for 10 pages. That proposal, this overall proposal about modern comedy, found its way to Simon & Schuster. The editors there contacted me. They said, we read this proposal you have about contemporary comedy. We think it's shit. We think it's stupid. We think it's boring. I think it's dumb. I said, yeah, I agree. And they said, however, this one chapter in here about indigenous comedians, that's really interesting to us. If you would like to write an entire book just about that, we'll give you a book deal. So I said, okay, that sounds good. But I also had like trepidation because I'm not native.
Yeah,
and
so, you're not an indigenous person. You have a very, I thought, thoughtful author's note. You do have one. Sorry, it's not gone. It's in the book, and I was going to ask you to elaborate upon that. You are not an indigenous person. I appreciate that you're self-aware about the implications of taking on such a project as a non-indigenous person. Can you, for those listening, how did you reconcile that fact, and how did you go forward?
I still haven't, I'm still developing ulcers about it right to this moment. You know, it's a difficult thing to navigate, not just to take on that project. You know, what right do I have to write about this? But also then the book is done, then you're promoting it. That's another like minefield. It's like sometimes I'm being interviewed about the book by a white journalist. I'm a white guy. There's no indigenous person in the room. I don't want to be speaking on anybody's behalf. And so when I composed this book, I really was intent on letting the contemporary performers who I spoke to speak for themselves without me interpreting. So when you read the book, you'll see the majority of the modern comedians that I talk to, I'm not interfering. I'm not really editorializing. I'm not even talking much about their life. They are talking about their life. And in many of the chapters, you'll see and hear from performers who contradict each other or who have a different belief system or whatever. And so that is intentional to exemplify the diversity among different indigenous communities throughout the United States, Canada, wherever, without me filtering it through the prism of this white author. So I was real careful in doing that, and very upfront with everybody that I spoke to, you know, letting them know that I'm not indigenous and that it's a dodgy thing. There's such a legacy of racist historians, anthropologists, sociologists who are coming to their own conclusions and really dispensing disinformation, misinformation, stuff filtered through a racist lens. So I was aware of all of that. And so all of that gave me trepidation, and I was really trying to avoid that, and also to get the blessing or endorsement of the people that I was talking with. And I've been gratified by the response so far to the book that it's really been embraced by a lot of Native journalists and Indigenous book reviewers and other comedians and so on and so forth. It's been a uniformly positive response. But there's still skepticism when people don't know that before they've read that author's note, or they don't know who the author is and they just see a blurb on the front from Steve Martin. It seems like a weird divide. Like, here's a white celebrity. What does he have to do with indigenous culture? Not much, blah, blah, blah. So there's all kinds of like complicated considerations. So when I was researching the book, I had to research a lot more than just comedy. You know, I had to learn a lot about the nuances between various Native nations, the history of various dynamics between the Canadian government and First Nations peoples, or the U.S. government and Native Americans. You know, there's a lot of heavy history and sort of nuanced history that had very little to do with comedy that I had to kind of grasp before I could go any further. So it was, without question, the most difficult project to get correct that I have ever attempted.
Yeah. So within the author's note, you mentioned that you did confer with someone in kind of an advisory role, I would say. It doesn't sound like they co-wrote the book with you in any regard, but you, is that right? Did you get some sort of counsel?
I worked with a woman named Jessica Elm. Jessica is from John Hopkins University. She's Oneida. And one of the star characters of the book is a guy named Charlie Hill, who was a stand-up comedian who started in the 1970s. He also was Oneida. It is a Native nation, which is in the Midwest of the United States now. She was, I don't really have a descriptor for her, an advisor or a consultant. I guess you could choose any one of those terms. Mm-hmm. But she was somebody that I was on the phone with constantly. Once I had enough material to show her, and we went over it, and she flagged anything that she felt that was potentially problematic. There wasn't a lot. I'm happy to say that she was pretty much delighted with my point of view, but there were just general things to consider that she would point out that we would work on together. It was a bit of a laborious process, but also, of course, very necessary.
Did any of the feedback surprise you, per se? Like, I get what you're saying. It wasn't like you've done something completely wrong here, but did anything, were you like, oh, I didn't consider that, or was it simply like factual corrections?
Yeah, not really. It was like the things that I would come up with, I don't know, they'd be sort of meaningless, I think, to the listeners. They're mostly about the contradictions within various indigenous communities where there was no consensus about one thing. So, for instance, there's a phrase, I don't know if it gained traction in Canada at all, called Two-Spirit,
yeah,
which refers
it
to...
It does. It did. It has. Yeah, it has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Two-Spirit is in reference to the LGBTQ community within indigenous communities. And I had used the phrase Two-Spirit. I thought it was like a real progressive thing on my part to use the phrase Two-Spirit. And then Jessica told me, well, within many indigenous communities, there's no consensus about that phrase. And some people like it and a lot of people hate it. So I deferred to that note and decided not to use it and just to not use any phrase at all and just to not focus on sexuality in any sense, because there was a couple comedians in the book who were gay, and I thought, oh, I'll use the phrase Two-Spirit, and she said don't, because it's something that is popular amongst university students, but there's lots of elders who don't like it, and it's not a homophobic thing, it's just a thing that some people feel is not, I don't know, not every culture subscribes to the term. So, you know, things like that I wouldn't know any better. Being
sure,
a white white liberal, I would think, oh, yeah, definitely I'll use it. And, but it's not all, I mean, this should go without saying, but obviously not all indigenous people are the same. Not all Native nations are the same. And there are different nuances and things that people subscribe to some places, but not elsewhere. So I had to be aware of that.
Yeah, I was just speaking with a musician and a writer by the name of Leanne Batasimasak Simpson, who hails from Ontario, and we got into a discussion about, in her book, there's a reference to gender pronouns, they, them, gender pronouns, and sorry, I read two of her books recently, and I'm blanking on which one features this commentary, but she basically discusses the fact that in some aspects of indigenous culture, like, they, them is what they've always used. They very rarely use, you know, feminine and masculine pronouns. And I just had never heard that before. And it kind of reminds me, it reminded me at the time of the fact that there's just so much that I feel like we're all just catching up to indigenous culture in some ways. That's like a pervasive feeling I have. Like, if we just listened, we might be able to catch up faster. But every so often we in Western culture decide something. And if you do a little research and history, like you do, you will discover that indigenous people have been having these kinds of discussions or asking us to consider them for decades, if not centuries. So
there's an excellent book that you probably have talked about on your show before. It's a book from up north that I read in my research called Unsettling Canada by Arthur Manuel. That book was really important in my research and understanding what now I consider basic concepts, because he, Arthur Manuel, the writer of the book, describes it so efficiently and succinctly in an easy to understand way, concepts that I would have thought were complicated. I know in Canada, they reference UNDRIP a lot, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mm-hmm. That's in the news all the time. But how many Globe and Mail readers actually understand what that is and what that means and what's in there, the why and the how? And Art Manuel's book schooled me on what the doctrine of discovery is. And I can't believe that that isn't history 101 in any American history class or Canadian history class, learning what the doctrine of discovery is, because it's the basis for all of the wealth held by these respective countries. The doctrine of discovery was invoked going back to the 15th century by international explorers who were exploring, quote unquote, exploring under the flag of either Spain, France, England, Portugal, or the Dutch. And doctrine of discovery said that if you stumbled across a continent or a land that was uninhabited by Christians, even if it already had 5 million people there, if there were no Christians, if those 5 million were not Christian, then the rights of the land would automatically revert to the host country of the explorer.
Yes.
And that is how Spain, France, England, the Dutch, the Portuguese ended up owning North America. It was like this ridiculous law that they had created, a papal order, the doctrine of discovery.
And it's still, as I think you point out in your book, it's still invoked today.
Up until 2007, it was still the primary way that Canada defended any land title dispute when it came to pipelines. And then Prime Minister Stephen Harper's lobbyists worked around the clock for 4 years at the United Nations. And this is chronicled in the Art Manual book. The only four countries on earth that refused to ratify UNDRIP, because the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples declared the doctrine of discovery invalid, said this is no longer a valid law, it's a racist law, it's an insane law, and they compared it to the slave codes, the black codes, during the period of Reconstruction that disenfranchised African Americans with these bullshit laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so UNDRIP said this is no longer valid, and for that reason, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States refused to ratify the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Stephen Harper's lobbyists worked for 4 years to have an amendment added, and they finally succeeded in having that amendment added. And that amendment stated Canada will ratify UNDRIP so long as they never have to honor it.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, we will, it was in
name only kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I didn't know about any of that until I started researching this book. It seems like you would learn that the first day of school.
Well, there's lots of revelatory aspects to your book, and it really does read as it's a history of indigenous comedy, of course, but it does feel like a history of North America and entertainment mm-hmm. generally as it relates to indigenous culture. You mentioned Charlie Hill. Your book is named for the punchline of one of, if not his most famous joke. And I know there's lots of fascinating figures in this book. I want to home in a little bit on Charlie because you have made him he recurs. Among those who recur, he recurs frequently in the book. Can you tell the people who don't know about Charlie Hill a little bit more about him?
Sure. Charlie Hill, his most famous joke, I'll paraphrase it. He had his network television debut on The Richard Pryor Show in 1977. Richard Pryor had seen Charlie Hill perform at the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip, which is Hollywood's most famous comedy club, the Comedy Store. Been open since 72, and Charlie Hill moved from Wisconsin to California in late 74. And his opening joke was, and he did this on the Richard Pryor Show, his opening joke was, my name is Charlie Hill. I'm Oneida. My people are from Wisconsin. We used to be from New York, but we had a little real estate problem. And so that's the title of my book. We had a little real estate problem.
Yeah.
And Charlie Hill had always wanted to be in show business. He always was interested in comedy. He used to watch comedians on the Ed Sullivan Show and the Jackie Gleason Show. But he never really saw a path, you know. As a Native American in the 1950s and early 60s, you were only on TV if a white person was portraying you as a racist stereotype. Mm-hmm. There was really no progressive portrayal. There was no realistic portrayal. There was very few indigenous actors on the screen. And if there were, they were placed in the 1880s or, you know, in the past, as opposed to living in modern times. And so Charlie Hill really wanted to get into comedy. He just didn't see a path. He just didn't know. He was living on the reservation. So he really wasn't sure. He grew up in Detroit, and his father moved the family back to the reservation when Charlie was around 8 years old, because that's where his father had grown up, and he wanted to be back there. But he just didn't see the path. But eventually, a lot of comedians moved to Hollywood around that same time, because Johnny Carson had moved The Tonight Show from New York City to Los Angeles in 1972, the same year that the Comedy Store opened.
Yeah.
And it quickly became the casting ground for any comedian to do TV, the Comedy Store. And so Johnny Carson would mention it on his show. You can see so-and-so performing this weekend at the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip. And so a lot of comedians, Charlie Hill included, took that as a signal to move west, because maybe that would be the path to get on The Tonight Show. And for Charlie Hill, it turned out to be exactly the case. He moved to Hollywood in 74. By 1978, he became the first Native American comedian to appear on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. To this day, he's still the last indigenous comedian to perform on The Tonight Show. So all throughout the 70s and 80s and even into the early 90s, Charlie Hill was the Native American representative in comedy, really the only one of any magnitude. He had done Johnny Carson, The Richard Pryor Show, Merv Griffin, The Mike Douglas Show, Arsenio Hall. He wrote on Roseanne. So he had all these credits, but there were very few other indigenous people or even opportunities for indigenous people in comedy at the time. But unbeknownst to Charlie Hill, that whole time that he was appearing on TV throughout the late 70s, all throughout the 1980s, into the early 1990s, there were young indigenous children watching him, being inspired by him. And the people that I spoke to for this book, whether they were doing improv comedy or sketch comedy or stand-up comedy or writing TV shows, pretty much all of them said, yeah, I was 10 years old, I saw Charlie Hill on TV, and that changed my life. Or I was attending university, taking some courses in such and such, Charlie Hill came to my school and performed, it changed my life.
Yeah.
Instance after instance after instance, I talked to people who said they became a stand-up comedian or they got involved in comedy because they saw Charlie Hill, and he sort of exemplified the possibilities. Here's an indigenous person on TV, not pretending to do anything else, not selling themselves out to do a stereotype, but being proud of who they are, saying to the world, my name is Charlie Hill, I'm Oneida, and then telling jokes, being funny, being a stand-up comic, existing in the present, acting like a human being instead of some white racist concept of what a Native American person is or what an indigenous person is. And so simply by appearing on TV in the mainstream, Charlie Hill was this revolutionary character who inspired dozens and dozens and dozens of young indigenous people to get involved in comedy. And so now, pre-pandemic, like I said, there was this mini comedy boom of all these new young indigenous performers, and nearly all of them could trace their inspiration to Charlie Hill. So he's the central figure and character in this new book for that reason. And I don't think it had ever been previously acknowledged, except maybe privately in some indigenous communities, just how much of an influence Charlie Hill did have, because he never became a mainstream household name in any way, despite doing those big shows. He never became a huge star. And in later years, even while he was still alive, his star kind of faded. And so for that reason, he was never really considered a historical figure, I guess. They just did a Comedy Store documentary on Showtime, a multi-episode documentary, and Charlie Hill is not mentioned in it. And I find that a little bit strange, because in this era, as we celebrate diversity, especially here in Hollywood, you know, if somebody is the first Black performer to do anything, we'll celebrate it. The first Latino newscaster or actor or whatever, we'll celebrate it. And yet somehow the fact that Charlie Hill was the first Native American comedian on network television in primetime, in late night, it just kind of gets forgotten or missed or overlooked. So I'm trying to frame that in its proper context and place Charlie Hill in comedy history in a position that he deserves, because not only was he the first indigenous comedian to do these major shows, he inspired a whole new generation of indigenous performers and comedians. And I think that's really important.
Well, and I think that what you get to quite a bit is sort of the power of representation in media across generations, or in popular entertainment, whether you're talking about Will Rogers or whether you're talking about indigenous-oriented comedy specials that are aired on CBC TV here in Canada or even APTN, you know, these which is the, I forget what that acronym is off the top of my head. Do you remember?
Aboriginal People's Television Network.
That's correct. So just seeing themselves on screen or on stage or in a theater, how important would you say that is to budding comedians? I think the answer is obvious, but I do feel like that's a central tenet of your book, is that just the fact that people like Charlie Hill or the 1491s, they get up on stage and potentially reach the next generation of entertainers who see a future for themselves, not just see themselves, but see like, oh, wait a minute, I could maybe do that. Like, how integral to your story, if you will, in this book, how integral is that to your story?
Well, you know, when I started writing this book, I did not have a central theme in mind. I found the theme as I researched the project. So I never went into it thinking Charlie Hill is this hugely influential figure or even this really important figure. It never dawned on me. I knew that he existed, that he had done The Tonight Show, and I wanted to research his career. But I had no knowledge of the cause and effect, the ripple effect, the domino effect, whatever effect that representation can have on people, until I started interviewing people and his name just kept coming up again and again and again. And that faced me with the most obvious theme, which is that representation matters. And that when you eliminate that representation, what bubbles up in its place is often something harmful. You know, when you don't have indigenous people behind the camera, but you're doing a project that's about indigenous peoples, there's a strong chance that what ends up on the screen is going to be all fucked up. You know, it's going to be, if not racist, then just ill-informed. And when you have Native people in control of Native stories, then there's this potentially positive effect that occurs.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, there's also in your book, like, intergenerational tension. When I think of Williams and Ree and how they're depicted in the book, I mean, I'll let you talk about them a little bit first, because maybe just to contextualize them, there is, but I will say, like, in the book, there's this incident where I think, you know, it's a very unfortunate incident where, you know, they're doing kind of classic vaudeville comedy. Is that a fair way of classifying what they do?
Sure, old-fashioned comedy, yeah.
Yeah, and so they're not really up on just what the next generation is thinking and doing, and they end up in a situation in Saskatchewan where they put on a show and they're highly insensitive to the mood of the room. And there's a few instances where you depict this sort of clash of wills and styles and people resenting one another. So it is it's a bit fraught on some level too. It's not all, not everyone is bound together by their indigenous heritage, if you will. There's tension as well, right?
Well, of course not. I mean, that's, again, throughout history, indigenous peoples have been stereotyped, right? And now as we come to a position in our societies where we try and circumvent the stereotypes, sometimes new stereotypes are created. So a lot of non-natives want to think of indigenous peoples as all being the same, you know, and when you hear from one indigenous person that they're speaking on behalf of everybody. But of course, that is impossible. And there are hundreds of different native nations and hundreds of different languages and hundreds of different belief systems and whatnot. So of course, you're going to have some contradictions. And then just normally, as with anybody, there's always a generational divide between young people and old people, no matter what culture they belong to.
Yeah.
So that's true here too. And that's highlighted in the book. And that also is intentional. I want people to come away with an understanding that there's a diversity of opinions, even if that diversity of opinions is an opinion that you personally might hate. So, you know, I don't like Prime Minister Stephen Harper, but he still exemplifies a diversity of opinion among Canadians. So in America, everybody thinks that Canadians are so nice and so socialistic. And I go, well, Stephen Harper is very much an American style politician and much maligned in Canada. You know, people always say, oh, Canadians are so funny. And I'm like, man, I can introduce you to some really unfunny Canadians.
You know? Yeah, no, it's a diversity and all. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I appreciate that you want to point those differences out, whether they're generational comedy styles. I mean, the 1491s, I think, almost their origin as a sketch troupe was really almost in opposition to the way indigenous people were depicted both by outsiders and within, you know, as this dour, sad group of people that never laugh at anything. I do think that's a central tenet of the book as well, is this feeling that, you know, indigenous culture, indigenous figures are always presented as very self-serious and solemn. And that's something that a lot of indigenous comedians can play against, I suppose, or, you know, use as sort of a source of their material. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious, it should go without saying, but for some reason you have to say it, is that people are people. You know, there's no such thing as a whole swath of people that don't smile and laugh. That doesn't exist. Yeah. Some people laugh more than others. Some people are funnier than others. Some people have a better sense of humor than others. But all of those elements exist in all of humanity, regardless of race, ethnicity, culture. I mean, that should go without saying. But the success of stereotype propaganda in media, in movies, in television, in music lyrics throughout the history of show business has been very insidious in brainwashing people into thinking things that aren't true are the case. And, you know, we're getting to a point, I hope, where we're beyond that. But then, of course, there are new stereotypes that are derived. So in the 90s, there was this sort of trend of Native American themed movies because Dances with Wolves was so successful, and it created this new era of stereotype of the all-knowing, communicating with nature and the clouds, and like the peaceful, passive stereotype, as opposed to the hostile villain stereotype.
Well, it's interesting. As you were speaking, I did have a thought. I was thinking about Charlie Hill and his relationship to some of the most popular comedians of our time. You mentioned Richard Pryor. I believe at the time, Robin Williams was still kicking around the Comedy Store. David Letterman was on the come up. And Letterman was someone who valued Charlie, I think. He made a point. There's a point in the book, I believe, where Charlie is looking for some help in his career and basically calls up David Letterman, and Letterman has him on The Late Show with David Letterman, which is a remarkable story in itself, a remarkable story of connection. I'm guessing you did reach out to David and his people about participating in the book.
I didn't connect with Letterman this time. I'm not sure what happened. The guy that I talked through to get to Letterman last time I did this book writing process, when I was writing The Comedians, My History of Stand-Up, the first book that I did, I think Letterman was still doing his show, his late night talk show. So mm-hmm. the connection I had was you go through a person to get through that person. And now that he is not doing that show, I think he has different people, because that email went nowhere. So I didn't get a chance to talk to Letterman or Leno, but I did speak with a number of people from Charlie Hill's past, like Buffy St. Marie, mm-hmm. Lindsay Wagner, who played the bionic woman on television in the late 70s. They knew Charlie Hill early on. Buffy St. Marie, in 1975, Charlie had barely been doing stand-up for 6 months, and Buffy St. Marie made him her opening act. He was opening for Buffy St. Marie, mostly playing indigenous gigs, and brought Charlie a whole new audience. People had not seen a Native American stand-up comedian before. And so he had these two worlds. He would be doing open mics with Letterman in the San Fernando Valley, or doing the Comedy Store with Robin Williams. And then he would go on the road with Buffy St. Marie, doing gatherings, doing different powwows and festivals around the country. So he got a lot of help early on, a boost from certain people. And then after he did the Richard Pryor show, which was a very successful stand-up appearance, it was a primetime NBC show. The show itself didn't last long. It was low-rated. 15 million people saw Charlie Hill's stand-up debut, and that was the lowest-rated show of the evening.
Really?
Back in that era of three networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, 15 million. If your show was only getting 15 million viewers a week, they would cancel the show because you weren't doing the numbers that constituted a hit show. Today, that would be the number one show, 15 million viewers. But back then, it was different. And so, anyways, 15 million people, still a lot of people. And so Charlie Hill got a lot of work because of that appearance. One of the things that he got was a guest role on The Bionic Woman, which at That's the time right. was one of the most popular TV shows going. And Lindsay Wagner was the star of that show. They struck up a friendship, a relationship, some people say, and we're together for several months. I got to talk to Lindsay mm-hmm. for this book. Her reminiscence was really interesting. Got to talk to Buffy St. Marie. Her reminiscence was really interesting. Got to speak with Roseanne off the record. She sent me some material.
Because Charlie write for the Roseanne show?
Yeah. Charlie became a popular comedian right at the right time. So he did Carson in 78. And right in that era is when comedy clubs started to really open up. And by the early 1980s, there were comedy clubs all over North America. There was hundreds and hundreds of comedy clubs in the 1980s. One of them, which still exists, was called the Comedy Works in Denver, Colorado. And when Charlie Hill was booked to headline the Comedy Works in Denver in 1982, the opening act was just a local open micer named Roseanne Barr.
Yeah.
So they met each other in 1982. And then in the early 90s, when Charlie was having trouble securing work, he wasn't making a lot of money, a bunch of his old Comedy Store friends were writing on the Roseanne show, and so they brought him in to help write a Thanksgiving themed episode. And that episode went well enough that they hired him full time, and he was a staff writer on Roseanne in one of its final seasons.
There you go. Yeah, so the real loyalty there that I appreciate about the book too. You know, comedians can be depicted as really cutthroat, competitive. But I like, you know, I think, Cliff, I loved your book, The Comedians, and I recommend, I bought that book for people as gift, you know, as a gift. I send it around whenever I think of it, and I think it's wonderful. But yeah, the camaraderie, you know, we talked about some of the tension, I guess, but I think in this book, in the new book, but I do think the camaraderie is really remarkable, and I appreciate how much Charlie resonated with his fellow comedians as a comedian, whether or not he was a Native American, indigenous, what have you. They just seemed to really enjoy hanging out with him, and he seemed like a nice guy.
Yeah, he was much beloved, very supportive, what I would call a generous laugher. You know, it didn't take much for him to burst out laughing, and comedians love being around people that are easy laughers. Not easy laughers in the sense that they're insincere, but sincerely give it up when something's funny and let out a big belly laugh.
Yeah.
Charlie Hill always did that. And, you know, people who were regulars at the Comedy Store often talk about his laugh. It's very seldom that you hear people describing a comedian's laughter. Charlie Hill, his laugh would echo through the room, and you always knew it was him laughing. It was very identifiable. So he was a great guy to have around, and a really supportive guy, had no jealousies, had no hang-ups about his fellow comedians. He was just a lover of comedy and a supportive guy and much beloved, and for that reason well remembered still to this day in glowing terms by his contemporaries. And you're right, like, often that's not common in comedy. There can be a lot of hostility and a lot of contempt. You know, comedians do not like to associate with people they don't consider funny.
So if you
show up on the stand-up scene and you have not proven yourself yet on the stage, comedians are not nice to you. They don't say, "Hey, nice to meet you, good luck." They ignore you. Once you prove yourself on stage as a funny person, then they'll want to know you. Charlie Hill didn't have those attitudes. He would treat everybody equally, whether they were a big star or just an audience member or whatever. He treated everybody equally. And so for that reason, he was much beloved. But that is a very rare attitude within comedy.
Yeah, there's a few lovely anecdotes along those lines of younger generations of comedians encountering Charlie or finding themselves on a bill with Charlie in his more advanced years, I guess, and him just being so encouraging as they got off stage.
Well, actually, I heard a story. I don't know. Maybe it's not in the book. He did eventually take on that role of the sort of elder statesman, the encouraging statesman. But in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, as his career was slowing down and the first wave of new indigenous comedians were starting to emerge, you know, maybe 8 or 9 or 10, and they're almost all men, 8 or 9 or 10 dudes, native dudes, who started doing comedy around that time. Charlie initially was resistant. He did not want to encourage them, and he did not want to take the credit of having inspired him. One of his friends told me this because he wasn't sure that they were funny, and he did not want to be the guy blamed for encouraging somebody who should not, in his opinion, be encouraged.
Yeah.
You know, because he still believed that you should have the goods, that you should have the talent, that not anybody can just do comedy.
Yeah, so he was a craftsman, real craftsman in that regard. Yeah, yeah.
So he was resilient to accepting that credit until a few years later, when there were some people on the scene that he could be proud of, and then he sort of did grow into that role. But initially, he did not want to encourage anybody who followed in his footsteps in the early 2000s anyways, because he apparently did encounter a comedian or two that made him cringe, and he really did not want to be taking the credit as their inspiration.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but yeah. Yeah.
That's a little quality control. That's good. I don't resent him for that. That's good, actually. That's good. You know, earlier you were talking about how the book was received, I think, mostly from maybe some of the subjects of your book, other members of Indigenous or Native American communities. What about other receptions? Has anything surprised you? I will tell you candidly, you know, I've tried to pitch your, you know, coverage of your book, and I'm getting that resistance that we talked about earlier in the conversation. Well, this is a white guy writing about Indigenous culture. What do we, no, we can't touch this. And I was like, really? That seems not good, because he's really making a point of giving people space and a platform to tell their stories, and also to tell these really lost to history anecdotes that I found utterly fascinating. Are you encountering any challenges in getting people to embrace this book beyond the people you alluded to earlier, who have sort of been, you know, expressing gratitude to you about it?
I want to know who said that to you.
Well, I'll tell you. I can tell you, but I'm just curious. Have you encountered this yourself in any?
No.
Okay. Good.
No, I have not.
Good.
I have not. I guess if it's happening, then it's behind closed doors.
Yeah.
I guess I thought it would gain more traction in Canada than it has, because Indigenous issues are at the front and center in the media in Canada, and they're not at the front and center here in the United States. And so I thought that maybe it would be a breakout book in Canada more than the United States, and it has been exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It's been more embraced in America than Canada. It might be because it has the term Native Americans on the cover instead of First Nations or Indigenous. People might think that it doesn't have a First Nations angle, which it does very much. There's
yeah.
a lot of
yeah.
American and Canadian, and you know, I don't really acknowledge the difference between the border when it comes to the history of Indigenous peoples. So no, I haven't necessarily encountered that resistance. If it's there, I'm just not being told of it or aware okay. of it.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Don't shoot the messenger here.
I'm fascinated by that.
I will say that to those I've pitched it to, I pitched it when I first heard about it, and then I hadn't read your author's note. You know, the question did come to my mind as well. Like, what is this? But I also knew your other work. I knew you from your Vice series. I knew your previous book, The Comedians. I knew you would take a nuanced and sensitive and thoroughly researched approach to this book. So I think I'm going to repitch it now that I've, like I say, I'm in the midst of reading it for a second time just because I enjoyed it so much. So I think now that I have a better handle on it and I have the author's note, that'll help. I just want people listening to know that I think you've given this book and the work you had to do here, and the somewhat awkward position you were put in, I suppose, you gave it all full consideration, and I think that comes through in the book. If, like, when I look at it, chunks and chunks of other people's voices, you know, paragraphs of just people talking. You editorialize where you must, and you add context, but it's really just other people's voices that you have taken, I think, great care in presenting.
Yeah, the contemporary stories are basically oral history.
Yeah.
You know, it's people talking, and I'm not in those chapters at all. And then with some of the older historical stuff, Will Rogers, then my voice is in there a little bit more. But even somebody like Charlie Hill, who passed away in 2013, his story is being told by people like Buffy St. Marie or his older brother Norbert or his daughter Nazba or people that knew him more than I. I mean, I did the research, but these people are telling the story. So that was really an important consideration. It is a little bit of a difficult book to market for a number of reasons, not just the fact that I'm a white guy who has written this book, but just the concept. You know, it's so unknown, especially to people in the United States who are like, oh, Native Americans and comedy. They're trying to grasp what that means because there's no famous figure, you know, like a Richard Pryor or a George Carlin. So they're trying to think like, well, what does that mean? And I think I'm guessing that a lot of people think of a stereotype like, oh, it's about humor and culture and what does the eagle teach us? You know, like some sort of
sure. Yeah.
Some sort of ridiculous dances with wolves type stereotype must be conjuring in people's non-native minds, I think, when they hear about it. It is a book about comedy. It's a book about show business. It's very much in tune with my previous book, The Comedians, which was a history of stand-up. If you like that book, you'll like this book. And if you didn't like that book, you'll still like this book, is what I keep saying.
I think, you know, you alluded to the fact that that Comedy Store documentary doesn't feature Charlie Hill, despite what a landmark figure he was for Indigenous comedy. But they made a point of talking about, I think you said this, and I didn't watch that whole series. I watched a couple episodes. But you made a point of them seemingly celebrating, you know, when black comedians rose there or Latino American comedians rose there. I think there's something going on. You know, here in Canada, we had an analysis of our treatment of Indigenous people, and it was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah.
That sounds very serious, and it is. And I think we take it. So, you know, to your point, here in Canada, I think it is taken very seriously, but with sensitivity and whatnot. I don't know that people are maybe in Canada ready to embrace, you know, a comedic angle on the Indigenous experience in this country or in America. If that makes, does that make any sense? Like, there's just something.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, the people who said that to you, I don't know who they are. How many of them were First Nations peoples?
None.
And how many?
None.
Exactly. Okay. So there you go.
Yeah.
So I'm getting great endorsements from First Nations Canadians and journalists. And I'm not saying this to defend myself. I'm saying this out of gratitude. I'm very grateful to have people like the Ryan McMahons, Dakota Ray Heberts, and the other people that I know up there endorsing this book and getting behind it and feeling that it's necessary and that it's going to fill a gap, hopefully. So I get that. Yeah. I also read a book in the research called, I'm going to paraphrase the title because I don't remember the title off the top of my head, but it was something along the lines of Indigenous Rules of Style. And it's a book, I think the scholars are from Alberta, maybe.
Huh.
But a couple of Indigenous professors put together this booklet, which is a guideline for non-Indigenous people like myself who are writing about Indigenous topics.
Yeah.
And it really is a book of suggestions. You know, it's like what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But it also has a lot of nuance in it. Like early in the conversation when I was telling you about this debate I had, not a debate, but a conversation about the phrase Two-Spirit. This book, Indigenous Rules of Style, again, I'm not sure if that's the exact title.
Yeah.
But it gets into that, what you should consider, what you shouldn't consider, who you should talk to, who you should consult with before you make a decision, all these different types of things. And like I've noticed in this conversation, we use the term Indigenous in America. Native people still use the word Native. I guess that's not in common parlance in Canada anymore.
No.
When I lived in Canada, it was. So it's like all those sort of things that you have to be sensitive to, that you have to be aware of. What message are you putting out there? What are you considering, not considering? All these different types of things. It is a bit of a landmine.
Well, a lot of white guilt in it too, though. I mean, Thomas King's book, An Inconvenient Indian, has a whole chapter about this. Just like, yeah, white people want to call us all these different things. We call ourselves what we call ourselves. Leave us alone. You know, ostensibly. Like you can dance around all the different terms you want and change them whenever you want. Whatever. Doesn't bother us, whatever. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah, so nobody cares.
Nobody really cares, but white people care a lot. They want to make sure they're saying the right thing at the right time, and that's just the way it goes. So that's part of, that's probably part of it, too.
I think you would be hard-pressed to find anybody who would read this book and then walk away with the same apprehension that they have about it before reading the book.
Absolutely, 100%. And that's why I've decided to not only step on this landmine, but just, you know, hug it. I'm all in. I'm all in on this book. I think it's wonderful, Cliff. I think you've done a fantastic job, and I'm happy to hear the subjects of the book and other members of First Nations, Native American, Indigenous communities. They've all, you know, to your knowledge anyway, they've embraced it. That's important because I think you're giving voice to something that has been voiceless for many, many years, and it blew my mind. Like, I'm someone who studies comedy, and I didn't know this. So
not only is it important to me, it's the only thing that matters in terms of response to the book. I don't really care if it's a big hit or a small hit or a bestseller or whatever. I just wanted to please the Indigenous comedians that are featured in the book. I wanted to please people who love and remember Charlie Hill, and I wanted to please the Indigenous readership first and foremost. I'm glad that anybody else appreciates it, but that was my main concern. My previous book, The Comedians, which was a history of stand-up, I just wanted to please people that were comedians. Like not just, but that was like my main hope. You know, if I could get the endorsement of the larger comedy community for that first book, then I'd be happy. And if I could get the endorsement of the larger Indigenous community, this book, I'd be happy. And in both instances, that's what I had. So anything else beyond that is fine. But those audiences are really who I hope, when they compliment it, that's when it has the most meaning for me.
Well, I appreciate that, Cliff. Before we go, I do wonder, I don't know what you can divulge at this point, but you say you've been working as much as you usually would be during this pandemic. Have you thought of a next move per se, anything you're working on that you can divulge any details about at the moment?
Yeah, I could. I am a very, very lucky person. You know, my first book was published by Grove Atlantic. This new book is published by Simon & Schuster. Somehow I have tricked people into accepting me into legitimate society. You know, the fact that I'm a published author is absolutely incredible because I really am a bum, and anybody who knows me will verify that. I am really a slovenly, lazy bum, and that is why I do what I do, though, because I quote-unquote studied show business. But what does that mean? It means you just watch TV all the time.
That's so fine. I used to say that to my mother when she's like, "What do you?" I used to tape Letterman and then watch it when I got home from school. And my mother once was like, "What are you doing right now?" And I just muttered homework, and she didn't like that. She didn't like that little muttering at all. But no, a lot of us are like you, Cliff. You're the most successful version of us there is on some level. Published. You know, are you still, by the way, are you doing comedy? I know it's impossible for anyone to really do comedy the way they used to, but are you still a practicing comedian, so to speak?
No, I've been retired from stand-up for many, many years. Oh. Never did it in America, really. Only ever did it in Canada.
Oh, okay.
I still have all my press framed from like 2001, 2002, 2003. I have posters and the cover of the Georgia Strait that I was on, and this stuff from my stand-up career is framed on my walls here in Hollywood. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
Phase of my career, because I was like 21, 22, making some waves. But no, that's a whole different
thing. That's
all
gone. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the weird thing is, like, I was doing stand up when it wasn't that popular. It was like the 80s and early 90s comedy boom was long gone. And then YouTube, iPhones, Netflix, podcasts didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
So my stand up career was in the middle of those popular bookends. I was doing comedy during its most unpopular period and became popular while I was doing it, but maybe I quit at the exact wrong time, because as soon as I quit, then suddenly everybody sort of looked like me. Everybody was who I saw doing stand-up had like a hipstery post Dimitri Martin, Zach Galifianakis look to them, and it became like the biggest thing ever. Comedy just blew up, and I was like, holy Christ, like, had I kept doing it, I would have had like a good 15 years more experience than everybody else. I probably would have who knows what I would have been. But anyways,
right, sorry, yeah, yeah. No, I didn't mean to go down a bad part of memory lane for you there.
No, not at all. No, it's a good part of memory lane. It's just interesting to think like what my career would have or would not have been had I kept doing stand-up and not been doing what I'm doing now. But it's all connected. It's all related. All the things that I get to do as an author, you know, I get to do some big shows, and they're the types of shows that I would have had ambitions to do as a stand-up.
Yeah.
But I get to do them not as a stand-up, just as a book writer, whether it's Mark Maron's show or Just for Laughs in Montreal. I get to do all those things. And so all my ambitions that I had as a stand-up were kind of realized, except not as a stand-up, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so.
So you're working on something now.
Yes, yes. I'm writing a new book about the history of racism and anti-racism throughout the history of show business. So the new book will be a combination of my first book, The Comedians, which was a history of stand-up, and the new book, We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, the story of Native Americans and comedy. It takes the themes of both of those books and combines them into one and expands it even further beyond just stand-up, but television, film, music, radio, you know, the whole shebang. It starts with the history of blackface around 1830, post-Civil War, the emergence of racial stereotypes in vaudeville, and then just around the turn of the century, the emergence of the first protest movements against racist depictions on the stage or ethnocentric depictions in film and so on and so forth, coming right up into the present day.
Right. Wow. Well, that's, I mean, I was going to say what maybe prompted that, but given the way you've contextualized your other two books, and this and those maybe those processes, I guess it kind of makes complete sense that they might feed into this sort of broader view of
when the third book comes out, which I guess will be a couple of years, it'll fit in like a trilogy. The three books together will be a trilogy, and if you read them together, you'll come away with a real fully formed view of show business and of minority activism as well.
Sounds really fascinating. You mentioned a trilogy. Does that suggest we might also somehow get prequels? Because that's a big thing now. You can't just have the trilogy. You have to go back to before. Is that something in the offing?
Well, I would love to do a prequel. You know what I would like the prequel to be is before I wrote The Comedians, I had been interviewing elderly comedians who were in their 80s and 90s before they died. I would get their stories down. So people like Jack Carter and Irwin Corey and Shecky Green, all the people that were nightclub comedians in the 1940s and 50s, I interviewed at length. And some of them, like Will Jordan and Jack Carter, I did multiple sessions with over the course of months and even years and interviewed them for literally hundreds of hours about their encounters with Jack Benny or Al Jolson, all these figures from the past, you know. And Judd Apatow had a bestseller called Sick in the Head.
Yeah, I have it. It's right at my feet here. I have it, weirdly. I pulled it out the other day, and it's just on the floor here right beside me. So that's weird that you mentioned that. It's the only book in my, besides yours, it is the only book currently in my peripheral vision. That's weird.
Well, that book, as you know, is just a collection of transcripts of interviews that he did with notable comedians. So the reason I ended up getting my book deal for The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy was based on that stuff I had been doing, interviewing these elderly comedians. And then I turned it into a narrative, and a lot of the quotes that are in that first book are from that ongoing years of interviews that I had done with these elderly comedians, most of whom have since passed on. Hmm. So the prequel that I would like to do is like Sick in the Head Presents, and then just the transcripts of those interviews with these elderly comedians that served as the basis for my first book. Now, that's what I would like to
do. Does Judd know about this prequel idea that I thought I just made this up and we would go nowhere with it as a dumb little joke, but it sounds like you really thought this through. Is Judd aware of this idea?
Well, I never thought of it as a prequel before, but I think it fits the description here.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, that's fascinating in itself. That's cool. Okay,
no,
well...
I haven't I haven't mentioned it to Judd. I got to mention it to his publisher more than to him, really, because they're the ones who would have to sign off on exploiting the name,
right.
Especially if it – and it would be weird if it wasn't done with the same publisher to mention that.
Right.
But Judd Apatow is alphabetically the very first blurb on the back of the new book, We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy, available from Simon & Schuster now in hardcover, also – audiobook from Audible and a Kindle book for those of you who like to stare at a screen.
Yeah, and you've got Bob Odenkirk has blurbed it, Steve Martin, Philip J. DeLoria, Stephen Graham Jones, and David Truer. Yeah, it's a beautiful book, and I thank you for plugging it appropriately. If people want to learn more about you, Cliff, or follow you and your exploits on the social media, where would you like to send them?
Oh, unfollow me, please. I want to discourage people from using social media at all.
Okay.
So anything I can do to get people off of their phone, I would suggest if you want to follow me, the best way to do is to go to your local public library and type in my last name into the search engine, Nesteroff, N-E-S-T-E-R-O-F-F. Check out We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, or check out The Comedians. Follow me that way through the books.
Fair enough, Cliff. No one's ever done this on the show in the last few years. They just say, go to Instagram, go to Facebook, go to Twitter. Well, I appreciate that. And I'm
delete all three of those apps from your phone.
All right. Well, yeah, the book is wonderful. Again, it is called We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy. Cliff Nesteroff, it's really always a pleasure to get to speak with you, and I appreciate you and your work. I hope you keep going, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Vish.
Thanks for listening to this conversation with Cliff Nesteroff, who returned to this show, this time for the 618th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, I guess. You can also follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna on Twitter and on Instagram. I'm on both, maybe much to Cliff Nesteroff's chagrin there. But still, that's where I am if you want to follow the show and me. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content that I create. Well, I shouldn't say I create. I excavate. I find old archive interviews that I've done from my past. Well, and your past. My past is your past as well, when you really get down to it. Anyway, I've done a lot of interviews with people before I started doing this show, and so anyone who donates $6 or more on the Patreon there gets access to those archives. And as we're speaking of comedy, Neil Hamburger. I just excavated or unearthed Neil Hamburger, the first time I ever spoke with Neil Hamburger in 2006. So, again, if you're interested in exclusive content, or if you just want to support the show, please do so at patreon.com/creativecontrol. And note, I have some Creative Control t-shirts still in stock. So if you'd like one, message me on Patreon. We'll figure something out. Okay? Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by some amazing artists from all over the world. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Cliff Nesteroff. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you will read his book, We Had a Little Real Estate Problem. It's wonderful. And I hope you will consider subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends about it. Maybe they'll subscribe to it. Maybe you'll have a little like podcast club where you talk about each episode. Like in your living room with some coffee and some biscuits. That would be nice. Please consider doing those things. All of those things and whatever it is you do to engage with the show means a lot. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.